The views and opinions expressed by individuals on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of the network, Guys Guy Radio, and its platforms. It's Guys Guy Radio. Here's your host, Robert Manny.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, welcoming you to the show, where men and women can be at their best and everyone wins, Guys Guys Radio. We're here to inform you, inspire you, empower you, and get you to think, feel, and who knows, maybe even act by virtue of the journeys, stories, experiences, and insights of the guests I bring you each and every week to the show. And once again, this week is no exception. Today we're going to talk about sports. And we're going to talk about, in particular, the New York Yankees. And in particular, we're going to talk about the Steinbrenners, the Bosses of the Bronx, the new book by sports editor of the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro. Mike is joining us to talk about this wonderful book about the endless drama of the Yankees under the house of Steinbrenner. It's a fun read. It's a fun topic. I'm a huge sports fan, as you may have picked up by watching or listening to the show. And I'm a huge Yankee fan because I grew up in northern New Jersey and my folks introduced me to baseball by taking my brother and I to the Yankees Old Timers Day game year after year. And I've been a fan ever since. Even as I've moved to Southern California, and I'm a Padres fan now also, but in my heart, I'll always be a Yankees fan. Today, we're going to talk about one of the key figures behind the resurrection, if you will, of the New York Yankees, George Steinbrenner and his son, Hal, right here on this week's Guys Guys Radio. I think you're going to really enjoy the conversation. You know, the Yankees haven't won a World Series since 2009. What happened? We're going to find out. Was George Steinbrenner the last true sports owner willing to do anything to win? Maybe not, but we're going to find out. All from sports editor and author of the new book, The Bosses of the Bronx, Mike Vaccaro, right here on this week's Guys Guys Radio.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, Guys Guys Radio, it is the interview portion of our show, and today we're heading into the heart of baseball royalty, power, money, family legacy, and the relentless pressure that comes with wearing pinstripes. Our guest is the legendary sports columnist and author Mike Vaccaro, lead columnist for the New York Post and author of the new book. I'll hold it up right here because I'm in the middle of reading it, The Bosses of the Bronx. And I got to tell you, it is fantastic. It's a great, if you're a Yankees fan, you cannot miss this book. And if you're not, and you want to know what the fascination is with the Yankees and George Steinbrenner and his son, read this book, The Bosses of the Bronx. Now, Mike takes us inside the fascinating and often turbulent story of the New York Yankees and the Steinbrenner family dynasty, from George's fiery reign and obsession with winning to Hal Steinbrenner's more measured corporate leadership style in today's analytics-driven era. We'll talk championships, pressure, money, ego, loyalty. We'll talk about everyone from Reggie Jackson to Juan Soto. And if you love baseball leadership, New York sports history, or family dynasties, this is going to be a great conversation. So let's meet Mike Vaccaro. Welcome to Guys Guys Radio.
Thank you, Robert. It's good to be with you today.
So let's start right at the beginning. I mean, this is there's been a lot of books that have been written about the Steinbrenners and George in particular and the Yankees. So what inspired you to write this one? I know everybody's familiar with Bill Madden's biography of George, but this is a little bit different.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to set out to write a biography, Robert, because like you said, Madden wrote a good biography. Dick Schaap years earlier had done a very good biography of him. This isn't a biography as much as a slice of New York life, I think, from 1973 on, which is when Steinbrenner and his partners bought the Yankees on the way, all the way to today, where Hal, you know, oversees the old kingdom that his father created. I think part of what inspired me was to, you know, kind of give a real full accounting for a lot of people. You know, we're 16 years past George's death now. I think a lot of people only remember him as the kindly old man who would walk into Yankee Stadium and be drowned in cheers. And guys like you and me remember that about 10 years before that, he would walk into Yankee Stadium and the noise would be different, the words would be different, the sentiment would be different. But people don't remember that. You know, either they're too young to have gone through that, or, you know, some people like to use selective amnesia and only choose to remember the stuff at the end. And, you know, it was a fascinating 37 years that George owned the team. Fascinating time in baseball, in New York, in the country, but specifically with the Yankees. And, you know, he rescued the Yankees from near oblivion to where they're one of the top brands in the whole world, you know, baseball, sports, and otherwise. I thought it was certainly a story worth preserving between the covers of a book.
Well, you did an amazing job, and the attention to detail is incredible, and the writing style is wonderful. So thank you for putting this together. I'm thoroughly enjoying it, and I don't always say that to my guests unless I really mean it, and this time I do, and I highly recommend the book.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's terrific. So let's start with Steinbrenner himself. There's some owners just really transcend their sports they're involved in. Nowadays we have, and you love them or you hate them, or a little bit of both. Today we've got like Jerry Jones with the Cowboys. Before that, you had George Steinbrenner. Before him, maybe in a more cartoonish way, you had Charlie Finley. What makes mm-hmm. George Steinbrenner so special? And what was the most surprising thing you found out about him when you were doing the research for this book?
You know, I think what made him so special is that he really was a one of one. I mean, there isn't a, you know, yes, you can liken a lot of owners to him. You know, I think you're right. Jerry Jones is obviously a high profile owner, although mostly what he does is say silly things publicly a couple of times a week. Charlie Finley was very close to what George became. He just never had the resources behind him, and he was doing what he was doing in Oakland, California, rather than New York. So it was a little more muted. You know, I think the thing that surprised me about learning about George was just how profoundly he was responsible for making sure that the Yankees remain the New York Yankees. You know, when, you know, part of the reason why he was picked by CBS and his group was picked by CBS to get the team, they didn't have the highest bid, but they were the one with the loudest voice, you know, guaranteeing that New York would, that the Yankees would stay in New York. They already kind of had one foot out the door following the Giants to New Jersey, or there were other options. New Orleans was a prominent option. And, you know, a lot of the groups that were bidding more money were pretty adamant that they were probably going to abandon the South Bronx. William Paley, the legendary chairman of CBS, who already knew that part of his obituary was going to read that he'd let the Yankees kind of crumble. He also didn't want to be known as the guy who let the Yankees leave New York. And that was appealing to him. And so as a result, you know, George's group got the team for $8.8 million, which is just a staggering number. And the more staggering number is that George himself put up about $168,000 of his own money, which is, you know, really remarkable when you consider the fact that by the time he died 37 years later, he was a confirmed billionaire. So it's, you know, I think that's one of the things that you forget. Look, because George had his own dalliances with New Jersey, but for the most part, that was all done in the interest of making sure the new Yankee Stadium would get built, which it did. He would have liked it to have been built a couple of years before that. But there was some real sentiment because the Yankees were the number two team in town, and it wasn't close when he bought the team in 1973. The Mets outdrew the Yankees 2.5-1 most years. They were the team in New York. And, you know, George wanted to change that. George did change that. And, you know, through the sheer will of his personality, they were in the World Series 3 years later.
Now, what were – and he had promised that, that he would give me 3 years and he would do that. So what are the key steps he took to transform the Yankees, first of all, into a championship team once again, and then to really transcend baseball and make the Yankees really a true global brand?
Well, the guy who brought him into the Yankees basically was Gabe Paul, who was a longtime baseball man, who George knew from Cleveland. George almost bought the Cleveland Indians a couple of years before that, so we got to know Gabe Paul. Paul was just was a baseball lifer, a guy who had done every job in professional baseball, had never actually gotten the team of his dreams. I mean, he had helped build the 61 Reds, but he was gone by the time that team went to the World Series, and tough financial times in Cleveland kind of hampered him there. So when he was given the opportunity to find the Yankees for George, and then George reciprocated by bringing him aboard as first the GM in waiting, and then later the GM in full. That was really a huge moment for George. One of the things that George did that he was low-key not given a lot of credit for was he identified solid baseball people. He didn't always listen to them, and usually when the Yankees ran off the tracks, it's when he stopped listening to his baseball people and became his own baseball subcommittee. But when he listened to his own people, and look, I mean, it was helped along by the fact that George was suspended from baseball for 74 and 75, so Gabe Paul was basically allowed to build that team, with George not hectoring him every day. And he did. He was responsible for the bones of that team that wound up winning two championships. Later on, it was the same thing with Stick Mikel. Stick Mikel was a great baseball man, along the same profile of Gabe Paul, and exactly the same opportunity. George was suspended a second time for 2 years. Right. And during those 2 years is when Stick Mikel was able to rebuild the team without the interference from above that he normally would have had. And so you can maybe deduct points from George's tenure for not always being willing to follow a winning plan, a winning model. But we would have had half the stories in the book, and probably no book at all, if George wasn't the kind of guy who thought that he was the smartest guy in every room.
Now, George's approach, Mike, is a little bit different than some of the owners take in today's sports world, because he believed in star power. I mean, there's nothing new about that. Nowadays, it's still important, but he really was focused on star power at the expense of the minor league developing talent for a good portion of time. However, the team in around 96 all came out of the Yankee system. How do you kind of balance that?
Well, look, I mean, George was the one who identified Reggie Jackson as the first savior of what his vision was. And while other people in his organization wanted to go with other, they thought, smarter signings during that first free agency class of 76, 77, George said flatly, Reggie will put fannies in the seats. He understood the power of stars. And of course, he was right. Reggie was a guy who immediately put fannies in the seats, immediately delivered a couple of championships. But the problem is, I mean, the problem is that there were two Georges who ran the team. The one was a smart guy, like you mentioned, who was able to entrust lieutenants to help him build a great team, build a farm system. He understood that it was unsustainable to just buy the best player on the market every year. You needed a farm system that would be able to keep feeding you. And that was smart baseball decisions. He invested in infrastructure before it was fashionable. He invested in the farm system. The problem is he shared an office with the other George, who was the lunatic fan, the impatient, impetuous lunatic fan. And that was the guy who basically had the louder voice in the room. And so therefore, during the 80s, they would trade the likes of Fred McGriff and Jay Buhner and Willie McGee and Doug Graybeck, all in the interest of trying to pursue veteran names who were probably 4 or 5 years past their prime. And as a result, the Yankees went 18 years without winning a World Series. And it wasn't until later on, when Snick was kind of the guy who put in the blueprint, we're going to build around this core of talented players, see where it goes. And obviously it led to the most recent of all of our baseball dynasties. And I think that was when George finally realized that maybe you got to, take a step back, which is why, Brian Cashman was the last GM he ever hired, which is why Joe Torre was hired in 1995 and lasted until 2007, because George realized even George wasn't going to fire you if you kept winning every year.
George has been very volatile, obviously, with changing, churning through the managers, almost like, tissue paper. Did this chaos work for him, and did it work for the team?
No, in a word, no, it did not. I mean, the fact of the matter is that look, I mean, the Yankees were the model organization around 1981 or so, and it was his decision not to bring Reggie Jackson back. It was his decision to, after that, when they stopped winning pennants, to start trying to quick fix things, including firing the manager every year, firing the GM every year, firing the pitching coach, firing the PR director, always making Jay Buhner for Ken Phelps type deals, which drove, you know, Frank Costanza and every other Yankee fan crazy. And, you know, and the proof is in the pudding. I mean, look, they didn't go to the playoffs from 1981 to 1995. They didn't win a World Series between 1978 and 1996. That's really all you need to know. And it's why it makes me laugh now. People, you know, whenever the Yankees go on a small losing streak and my inbox gets filled with Yankee fans, you know, what would George do? What if George is still alive? And they get mad at Hal Steinbrenner. They don't think that he has quite the urgency that his father had. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the Yankees' current drought, if you will call it, want to call it a drought, is 16 years and counting. You know, George's drought was 18. I mean, that did not work. The way that Yankee fans believe that a lot of Yankee fans remember George is not the way it happened. You know, he'd snap his fingers. All of a sudden, if he'd fire somebody, he'd trade somebody, and boom, they would win a World Series. That's not how it happened, and that's not how it would happen now. And, you know, but you know what? People have their memories, and people just choose to remember George the way they remember him. And that's kind of the reason also why I thought this was a valuable book to have, is to remind you that George did a lot of good when he was the Yankee owner, a lot of good. A lot that people didn't even know about that he did, but was very good. He did a lot of bad. And to me, that's what makes a guy fascinating enough to write about.
Now, my special guest on Guys Guys Radio, sports columnist, New York Post editor, Mike Vaccaro. We're talking about the new book. Here it is once again, The Bosses of the Bronx. There was a time where, you know, George put together the winning team when he had 77, 78. He got Reggie. That was the, you know, that was really the catalyst to those years. And then he held on to some of those guys a bit long, Gossage and a few others, and the team kind of went down. And he had a fascination, of course, with Billy Martin. And then they had another mini resurrection when you had Winfield, Mattingly, guys like, and Ricky Henderson. Why do you think that group did not win the way the Reggie group won?
Well, the simple answer is they didn't have enough pitching. They never had pitching to match the incredible offense they had. I mean, the Yankees of those years started every game, it seemed like, 2-0, because, you know, Ricky Henderson would lead off with a walk and steal second. You know, Willie Randolph would either sacrifice him, hit a ball to the right side of the infield to get him to third. Mattingly would hit a sacrifice fly or drive him in with a double. And then Winfield would drive in Mattingly with a double. And every game seemed to start 2-0, but they never had the pitching to back that offense up. And because of that, George got crazy with, you know, not just the moves, but also becoming way too involved. I mean, the Yankees of that era had a term for it. They called it being Georged. You know, they'd be going along fine. They lose a couple of games. The Tigers were taken by a half game. All of a sudden, Steinbrenner would show up and issue his missives, and they go into a tailspin. That happened year after year, and he never learned from his mistakes. The one time he had a chance to really rectify this was after the 86 season, 87, going into 87, when he could have, you know, he could have retained Rod Guidry and Willie Randolph without any penalty. Could have gone after Jack Morris. Chose not to sign any of them because he meekly went along with collusion, which is the one part of his personality I can't explain, because it's completely against all of George's inner angels that he would have go along with the crowd, go along with the commissioner. But he did. And so that also didn't help at all, because they had a great chance to win that year and the next year, and just, they didn't have Jack Morris, and the Tigers did, which is basically what the story was told there. So, you know, that's the difference. And the fact is, you know, in the 70s, the Yankees were filled with teams that loved to go back at George. I mean, Reggie would always answer George back. You know, the manager, of course, would more than anybody else. I mean, you had Thurman Munson, Goose Gossage. These guys had no problem engaging with George, Greg Nettles. And, you know, George liked that. You know, he didn't like the fact that he would rip Dave Winfield, and Winfield will smile and say, well, as long as the man pays me on the 1st and the 15th, all's good by me. That's not how George liked it. And then he got frustrated. I think that helped explain maybe why he wanted to get more involved, because he just didn't think he had the same kind of battlers he had before. I think it's pretty simple. They just didn't have quite the pitching that they needed in order to compete in the American League in those years.
Now, why do you think that's the case, Mike? I mean, he had brilliant baseball minds around him, and George was no dummy. He understood how the game is played. He had guys like Don Baylor and Winfield and Mattingly and Ricky, but he couldn't win. Why not get the best pitchers?
Well, like I said, the one shot he had a chance to make everything right, he chose to go along with collusion, which is something I'm sure that he would tell you he regretted later on, although he never wanted to go on the record, you know, countermanding whatever Peter Uberoth was trying to do in those years. But, you know, I mean, pitching is not an easy thing to acquire. I mean, later on, they tried to Greg Maddux, when he was out of baseball, they finished second for him. They tried for years to build a staff, and they just couldn't do it. I mean, I think it's easier to build a powerful offense in Yankee Stadium the way the dimensions are than it is a pitching staff, and they just kept throwing, failed rotations at the wind, and they just weren't able to connect in the way that they the great rotations of the 70s, Catfish and Figueroa and those guys. And then later on in the 90s, when you had, Andy Pettitte, and you had David Cone, you had Roger Clemens, you had Dave. And I think also later on, when you were making your postseason lists of what you wanted, I think later on they realized you had to, include pitchers on that list every bit as much as sluggers.
What do you think was the catalyst to the resurgence of the Yankees in the 90s? They had gone through the 80s. They never won the big one with Winfield and Mattingly, and then they kind of fell off, and then they came back, and they had the core four of Posada, Rivera, Jeter, and Bernie Williams. What happened and what laid the front groundwork for getting those players into the system and keeping them?
Yeah, I mean, it's George getting kicked out of baseball, frankly. I mean, he was out of the way for 2 years when Stick Michael not only put together that team, put together an organizational philosophy where they were going to take a lot of pitches, they were going to have long at bats, they were going to make it hard on other pitchers, and of course, the players, the prospects they gathered, attended that church, so that was perfect. But also, they stuck around. There's no question. There's no question in the mind of my mind or anybody's mind. Watch those teams that if George were the guy making the final say decisions in those years, that at least one or two of the core four plus Bernie would have been gone. And maybe they still have enough to win one or two. They're not going to win four out of five, and they're not going to win. It's going to be a whole different realm. And because George wasn't able to make those decisions, because Stick Michael was allowed to say this is the way it's going to be. Those guys stuck around. They were allowed to go through growing pains in the minor leagues, sometimes growing pains at the major league level, and together they formed the basis and the core for a remarkable team. I mean, that's the long and the short of it. I mean, the irony for is, look, I mean, I'm I don't want I mean, I didn't write the book to diminish George's legacy, because clearly that was 37 years that made the Yankees prominent in the world to a degree that even the Yankees had never been before. And George gets every bit of credit for that. He gets every bit of credit for hiring the likes of Gabe Paul and Stick Michael. The fact of the matter is, their two eras of prosperity were almost entirely built when he was in absentia.
That's absolutely amazing. I guess the core four member I didn't mention was Pettit, right? Andy Pettit is the fourth.
Yeah, it was, I mean, somebody needs to come up with a rhyme for five, because Bernie belongs in that group along
Right.
with Pettitte and Jeter and Posada and Mariano. I mean, that's a good core four, but Bernie was every bit the core member of that group and also a homegrown guy. And so somebody needs to come up with a rhyme that starts with five.
Now, why do you think George didn't really get on their case? Obviously, they won a lot, but he didn't seem to get in their face and tweak them the way he did with Winfield and Baylor and Reggie and even Munson. He really and Piniella, he got on those guys' backs a lot more than he did with the core four plus Bernie.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, I think people have always asked me, what do you think? Which champions did he like more? I think he personally liked the 70s team more, because they won, but they were also willing to fight with them on the back page. I mean, the back page was theater to him. It wasn't just, a place to lodge complaints. I mean, that was how he kept the Yankees in the news 12 months a year. And those guys were always willing to fire back. I mean, Duke Gosch once, called him the fat man, challenged him to a fight upstairs, tell a fat man that I'm looking for him. Other than David Wells, there really wasn't a guy on the modern Yankees that had any interest in getting after with the boss. I mean, and frankly, who are you going to get after? I mean, you're not ever going to go into a tabloid fight with Bernie Williams or Andy Pettitte. I mean, that's just a waste of time. Derek Jeter one time, he talked about how he went out too much, and of course, because they're both guys who always try to wind up making chicken salad out of the other stuff. They wound up doing a commercial together, a Visa commercial, and they wound up running for a year and a half, and they probably both wound up adding, additions to their houses because of the residuals from that commercial. So, but that was really the only time. And even Jeter then did so. When George said he party too much, I mean, Jeter's response was, "I like to go out once in a while, but I'm not exactly Dennis Rodman," and that kind of defused the situation. So there was never, any. The boss going after captain, and then captain going after the boss. You weren't going to get that the way you did a generation earlier, when you had Thurman, Reggie, and Nettles and Gossage all lining up to take swings at George, and Billy, ready to do it whenever they were tired.
Now, you had a Bill, George had an obsession with Billy Martin. It seems like he brought him back four or five times. I lost track after four. And then finally, Billy died on Christmas Day in a car accident. But then he hires a guy like Torrey a few years later, a very, very different. What made the change in George? How did he see a guy like Torrey who did not have a reputation that or the personality that Billy Martin had? How did he make the grade and get the job?
Yeah, it was definitely against character. I mean, Arthur Richmond, who had worked with Torrey when they both worked for the Mets, and this is a baseball guy, so anybody in baseball knew Joe Torrey, knew what a gentleman he was, knew what a good baseball mind he had. So it was heavy recommendations. That's the reason why he went with Torrey, but he was definitely out of type, out of character. I mean, the guy, the quintessential manager for George Steinbrenner. Well, actually, it probably would have been Woody Hayes, but since Woody Hayes wasn't available to manage baseball teams, or Bobby Knight for that matter, he went with Billy Martin, who was basically the same character of those guys, the same took the same approach. And George was an old football coach, and he was never able to be disabused of the fact that baseball is a different sport than football. Maybe you don't run your baseball team the way you would your football team. But look, I mean, they both hated losing more than they loved winning, and that's the reason why they got along so well, and also why they usually wound up driving each other crazy to where, he was hired and fired five times, and almost certainly there would have been Billy Six if he hadn't passed away on Christmas Day, 1989.
Okay, my special guest on Guys Guys Radio, Mike Vaccaro, the new book, Bosses of the Bronx. I'm about three quarters of the way through the book, and it is absolutely fascinating. And the change between the Billy teams and then the Torrey teams is like night and day. What happened with guys like Clemens and Andy Pettitte? They had kind of a falling out with the Yankees, and I think they went away and they came back again. Talk to us a little bit about that, Mike.
Look, I mean, it was a different time. I mean, the fact of the matter is that George can convince guys like Cat Bechuner and Reggie Jackson to become Yankees and not make the highest bids for their services. Much the same way they got that George had bought the Yankees without making the highest bid for the Yankees. He was able to sell Reggie and Catfish on being Yankees, on New York City, on what that would mean to them, to their careers, to their legacies, to their Hall of Fame credentials. And those, those are two guys who were willing to buy that. They believed it. A lot of guys in those years were willing to believe that maybe, there was something other than just chasing every last nickel. That's obviously changed over years. That was part of the problem with Clemens for sure. With Pettitte, I mean, there were a couple of times Pettitte had been on the trading block, and George was always hot and cold with him. I think that him going to the Astros for a couple of years was kind of his commentary on how displeased that made him. But look, I mean, it's also the fact that when he got into the 90s and into the new century, the players held almost all the cards, and that wasn't they held a lot of the cards in the early days of free agency, but they were still kind of figuring out how that script would go. And so, George, the players were able to make more money, but they still, I think, had a lot of the old sensibilities of baseball, which meant a lot of where am I going to play, where can I win, and I think now it's a lot more of where can I squeeze the last nickel and last quarter?
A-Rod, what's your take? Having been around, and I'm sure you've talked to him many times, on the whole A-Rod saga with the Yankees. Started out great, incredibly talented player, agreed to move to third base to accommodate Jeter. And then they had a little bit of a falling out, and it didn't seem like they were close over the years. Now they're working together on Fox. And of course, A-Rod's been dinged a few times of with steroid allegations and has been withheld from the Hall of Fame. What's your take on that as a sports writer and somebody very close to the situation?
Well, we talked earlier about the reasons why I wrote the book, and all of the revisionist history that's gone around George. And honestly, I think one of the first seeds that might have been planted was, back when, things went south between A-Rod and the Yankees, and A-Rod was going to sue the Yankees, and the Yankees were, publicly, just basically screaming back at A-Rod. I would get these interesting emails from people who said, if George was still alive, this wouldn't happen. George wouldn't treat his best player that way, and that drove me insane because I said, you guys are clearly either 6 years old, you just choose not to remember who Howie Spear was, who Dave Winfield was, and the fact that, not only would George have engaged it, George actually blackmailed his best player. He tried to get dirt on his best player. So if you want to tell me that he wouldn't engage in publicly shouting down his best player, which was trying to sue him. I got another guess for you. So I thought that was interesting. So of course, it's interesting how people choose to remember George and how people choose to, fancifully think about how he would handle things. I think he would handle things every bit the same way that Brian Cashman and Hal Steinbrenner did when it came to Alex Rodriguez toward the end. And it probably would have been even funnier, crazier, zanier, pick your word, because that's just how George was. And I think that, I think you saw a little about how George would react toward A-Rod. For a couple of years, Hank was kind of the spokesman for the team, his oldest son. When A-Rod opted out during the World Series, Hank went bananas. And that was Hank, so it was a little muted because it wasn't quite George, but that's exactly what George would have done, because they were both, they were both wired the same way, which is part of the reason why I think Hal was a lot more logical choice to George, because he realized in the modern game, you needed somebody a lot more like Hal than you did like George, or like Hank even for that matter.
When George was headed towards his kind of demise, what was the kind of the passing of the baton? Which season was that? When did George kind of step back, and when did his sons take over?
Yeah, it was right around 2006, 2007. That's when he became more of an emeritus, more of an advisor, although he still had a very public opinion about Joe Torre during the playoffs of 2007 when the Yankees fell behind Cleveland. But it was by that time that, for a while you had Hank as the spokesman and Hal as the guy behind the scenes. And later on, they were forced to pick one, and Hal was the obvious choice. So obvious that, there was no succession-like drama to it. The other siblings all voted for Hal, and I think they're all pretty, Hank sadly passed away in 2020, but I think they were all pleased with with that choice, because Hal is a level-headed, smart, savvy business guy. And, it was also exceeding to the wishes of George, because I think George saw from an early age that Hal was probably the guy who was going to slot into that role.
I want to take a half a step back, if I might, Mike. I neglected to mention Buck Showalter. What's your take on what was his impact on the Yankees?
Well, if Stick Michael deserves the most credit for their renaissance and ultimately their dynasty in the late 90s, early aughts, then a very close second is Showalter, because he was a guy that Michael fired weeks before he hired him, because he just didn't think that he would be even a reasonable choice to interview for the job. But was told by other advisors, you should really talk to this guy, see what he's got to say, and hired him. And it was kind of a surprise, because even the Yankees in decline is a pretty plum job. But it was Stick who hired Buck, and Buck immediately went no nonsense. Immediately, anybody who's been around Buck for 5 minutes knows that this is one of the smartest baseball people there is. In my own career, I learned more baseball from Buck Showalter by just keeping my mouth shut and my ears open in pre and post game press conferences than anybody else, because he's that smart. And the results were on the field pretty quickly. Within 2 years, they were a winning team. Within three, they were knocking on the door with the Blue Jays. And by 94, they were running away with the American League East. His impact was enormous. I do wonder, there was a huge backlash when he was fired in favor of Joe Torre. But, of course, history will tell us that maybe that was the exact moment when they needed a different voice in the room. And obviously, Torre was a little less intense, a little less over the top in terms of details than Showalter was. I was more willing to just, absorb the George, onslaughts than Buck was. And it was probably, maybe as it turns out, the right choice for that job, But he was a fundamental part of the change of culture, and that culture, the seeds of that culture planted by Buck and by Stick in the early 90s is still really the basis of the Yankees culture right now.
We talked a little bit about Hal taking over from his dad and his more measured approach and more analytically driven, and he seems to have kept the same guys for a long time. You've got Cashman for how many years now? Like 20 years?
And that longer. I mean, longer. Yeah, he got the job in 98. So he's
always, wow. he's 28 he's, years.
He's knocking on 30. Yes. 24,
wow.
24 and, playoffs in 28 years.
So. And then as a Yankee fan, Aaron Boone has been the manager I'll just say it, far too long. I mean, after last year, one thing I notice about, I'm a lifelong Yankee fan. I live out here in the San Diego area. I've seen the trades between the two teams. I follow the Padres because they're the only game in town and they've got a good loyal base and they've got an interesting way of building the team. I don't agree with everything, but as I watched the Yankees and I watched them in the World Series against the Dodgers a year ago, their defense, they just have never been, in my opinion, since the Jeter days, their defense is not good. And it seems like those fundamentals really come back to bite them. And I think the Dodgers knew that when they played the Yankees, and they it turned out to be the difference in the series was that one play with Gerrit Cole.
Yeah. And look, I mean, that's the thing is, I think Hal understands that things aren't perfect and that, you know, probably if his father were still alive, we were still alive. I mean, Aaron Boone might be the manager, but he might be on the he might be on his third or fourth tenure, the way he did it with Billy Martin. Right. But look, I mean, I think Hal also understands that he looks across town, looks at the Mets, and realizes maybe not so easy to win 94, 95 games every year. And look, say what you will about Boone and what you will about Cashman. I mean, those guys get the Yankees in play every year. Now, are the things that you talk about reasons why maybe they aren't able to beat, you know, the best team in the sport in October? Maybe. Is there anybody out there who would guarantee you that they do better than those two guys are doing? I'm not so sure there is. I think Hal puts a value in that. I don't think it's forever. And I think the first time that they take a real step back, first time they go 80-82, he'll probably clean house or he'll be inclined to think about it more. But look, I mean, they moved on from Joe Girardi. So there is not a it's not a Supreme Court nomination for these guys. I mean, it's a, you know, they will be judged. They are judged. I just think that Hal has a better appreciation for the regularness of excellence, as opposed to, you know, taking a shot here and there and maybe, you know, falling on your face with that choice, which George did plenty also.
What's your take on the Yankees building their bullpen? They tried a lot of different closers, and I don't think they've ever gotten an elite guy. I say that as a Padre and Yankee fan, because I see the one strength that the Padres have is they're really good at, they really built an excellent bullpen, and they value that. And they get the lead, they're usually going to win, and they don't have that much else going. A couple of stars they have, but the Yankees are loaded, yet the end of their bullpen is very chaotic and inconsistent.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of Yankee fans have their memories seared by just the automatic nature of Mariano Rivera for all those years.
Right.
So that's a hard standard to live up to. And look, here's the thing, though. It's like, you know, Aroldis Chapman has spent a lot of his career as a lockdown, guaranteed closer, including for their fierce rivals, the Red Sox. I mean, he's one of the big reasons the Red Sox, you know, faced the Yankees in the playoffs last year. Yet his years with the Yankees, Yankee fans would just hide under cover whenever he would come into a game. They didn't trust him. I mean, I think that's part of it is the nature of bullpen anyway. I mean, there aren't a lot of Mason Millers. There aren't a lot of Mariano Riveras. There aren't a lot of guys who you can just hand the ball to and say, well, this is over. It's a very volatile line of work. You know, bullpens as a whole, you know, go hot and cold year to year, and so do relief pitchers. And it's hard to build. Look, I mean, the fact of the matter is I think the key, especially now, when we might be in the final hours of no salary cap in the sport, the best way to do it is to just flood the zone and get as many guys as you can to do the role and see who gets hot. You know, that's not necessarily a great way to do it if there's ever going to be a salary control in place, as there might be after whatever labor strike we're looking at next year. But for now, I think that might be the best way to do it because, look, I mean, I look through baseball and, you know, other than one or two obvious names, I'm not sure that I see a guy that I say, you need to get this guy. This guy will solve the ninth inning problems, and therefore you keep moving guys back. So that solves the eighth inning, that solves the seventh inning. And I think that's part of the problem is identifying who that guy is. And when you're the Yankees, you have the added burden of knowing that number 42 is not trotting down the bullpen anytime any soon.
Good point, good point.
Except on Jackie Robinson Day when they're all trotting in the bullpen. 42.
Okay, the Mets and the Yankees still seem to have that simmering rivalry underneath, and the new Mets management has kind of, I don't want to say poached, but they've kind of bought a lot of Yankees when they become free agents, and obviously the big one is Soto. So if you would, Mike, give us a little bit of a background about the whole Soto, you know, soap opera, and then the Mets seem to be enamored with taking Yankee guys who become free agents.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that Soto was a Yankee-specific deal for Steve Cohen. I mean, I think he's a guy that they both went after, and they both went after with big deals, and he was a trophy for Steve Cohen. I think the other guys, I mean, yes, they all played for the Yankees. I mean, you got a lot of names now, Peterson, Williams, and even Luis Severino and Harrison Bader came to the Mets after that. Weaver. I think that's more coincidental than it is we're going after Yankees guys. I think they just, they have their formulas for which players belong on their in their in their logarithm of a team, and those guys fell into it. I think Soto was a was an outlier when it comes to that, because I think he was a guy that Cohen just wanted because he was a Yankee.
Do you think that Soto wanted to be a Yankee, but he just went with the highest bidder? Or do you think, based on your experience, that he never wanted, he thought he might be number two because Judge is so popular?
I don't think those things factor in. I think Juan Soto is as close to a baseball cyborg as there is. So the emotional things that fans think about and that maybe other players think about, they don't really play into him. He wants to, he wanted to reach a certain number, and he did. He wants a place where he'll be comfortable enough to go to work every day, and I think he has that with the Mets. I mean, a lot of the stories now want to blame the alleged rift between him and Francisco and Lindor on him, but I think part of it is Lindor's a guy who's engaging and wants to be everybody's friend, and Soto just wants to go to work every day. And to him, it doesn't matter if he's doing that in Washington, San Diego, with the Bronx, the Flushing, or any place, as long as he's getting paid in the first and 15th, and he's allowed to prepare for games the way he wants to prepare for them. And I think he's just, he'll be a teammate and everything. But I think that things that we think should matter don't matter, and he's not the only guy like that. I think he can go chapter and verse in a lot of players in baseball who can adapt very well, given if they're given everything they want. And that's that. I think that's what Soto is.
Okay, last question. What do you think that, and along these same lines, Mike, what do baseball fans need to know about the game and about the business to really understand it better, instead of looking at things like what you just described about Juan Soto? He just wants to do the job. A lot of people think, oh, maybe he's moody, he doesn't want to be number two, and all of this kind of emotional stuff. What do fans really need to know to appreciate the game even more and watch the game in a more educated fashion?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't know if it's more educated or if it brings you more aligned to the way that things are done now, but look, I mean, it's a numbers driven game now, and we can break that into two divisions. One, the analytics, and there are a lot of fans who just hate the idea that analytics kind of rule the day now in baseball. I mean, they do. There's no question about that. They're going to for the foreseeable future. And the fact is that it makes a lot of sense. There is a reason why the best teams in the sport now are very analytically driven. It's still a talent sport too, though. So you have to have the best players. But that's the other part of the numbers involved, is that, look, I mean, it's not just as easy now as we're going to find the best player and then give him 10 years and X hundred million of dollars. I mean, people realize that the way baseball is, the way baseball players are, there's a certain shelf life to these players. I think the reason why Juan Soto was able to break the bank is because he was a free agent so young. One of the reasons why Pete Alonso was not is because he was past 30 when he finally hits free agency. And I think that matters to all owners, not just the rich ones, not just the poor ones, but even the rich ones. I mean, the rich ones don't believe in being baseball welfare either. And I think, you look back at the contract that Pujols signed with the Angels, and that they regretted that for many years afterward. We can go one after the other with a lot of players that were similarly aged poorly. And I think that those are the things that go into every thought that goes to building a team. And it's not just about, I can get this player, this player, this player, this player. Maybe that was more the case 20, 30, 40, certainly 100 years ago. But it's not the case now. It's more numbers driven, whether it's dollars or decimal points.
Amazing. Mike, this has been a terrific conversation, insightful, passionate, a real deep dive into one of the most fascinating dynasties in sports history. Once again, for Yankee fans, sports fans, leadership junkies, and anyone interested in power, family legacy, and the business of winning, this book, The Bosses of the Bronx by Mike Vaccaro, is essential reading. Amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show. I hope we can do it again.
Thank you, Robert. I hope so too.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning. losing teeth? What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, an amazing and insightful conversation with the one and only Mike Vaccaro, sports editor and author, sports writer and author extraordinaire. Mike really does an amazing job with this book, The Bosses of the Bronx, all about the Steinbrenners and the endless drama of the Yankees under the house of Steinbrenner. And I think the key word there is drama. It seemed like, from what Mike had to say, that George Steinbrenner, who really resurrected the Yankees and really made the brand transcend baseball, along with the 27-28 World Championships, was the conflict and the drama that surrounded the team, and the fact that George thrived on it. He liked it when his players pushed back. He liked it when his managers like Billy Martin pushed back, and he seemed to have a lot of fun with that and a lot of success. The most success the Yanks had under his tutelage really was probably in the 70s because of all the personalities there and the fact that they had been out of the picture for many years in the New York baseball and also just in Major League Baseball. They were not the championship team that they became again in 1977, 1978, until they put together this mix of the Bronx Zoo, as they called it, with you had characters like Sparky Lyle and Catfish Hunter and Thurman Munson and Greg Nettles and Ron Guidry and Reggie Jackson. It was just, and Billy Martin as manager, it was just a volatile mix. And they pushed back on their overbearing boss, George Steinbrenner. And you know something? It worked. Now, 20 years or so later, they came back again with a much more mellow group that was created, according to Mike, under the auspices of Gene Michael and company, and they put together the core four: Derek Jeter, Jorge Posada, Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettit, and of course Bernie Williams, the number five, the fifth Beatle, if you will. And they won championships in the late 90s, and they didn't have this conflict. However, they had George, and the fire was there, and I guess he changed his style a little bit, but he seemed like he liked the battles. He liked the conflict. He liked the drama of when he had those 70s Yankees. So it's interesting where you see the teams and the brands that thrive on the drama and the conflict and those that transcend the sport. Look at Jerry Jones now with the Dallas Cowboys. You love them or you hate them, but you know all about the Cowboys. They get a lot of press. If you watch any type of the ESPN sports shows, anytime anybody on the Cowboys burps, you know, there's a story about it. And I think it's because of Jerry Jones and his confrontational, chaotic style, if you will. And what is he going to do next? George Steinbrenner was the same way, as was Al Davis with the Raiders. So sometimes conflict works, and sometimes you take a brand and you can transcend the category of the sport you're in if you really know how to push it the right way. And apparently George Steinbrenner innately knew how to do it. Okay, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Guys Guys Radio on UK Health Radio. We're back next week with another great show. And until then, like I always say, guys, finish first.